From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, Illinois lawmakers have missed their first self-imposed deadline to pass a new state budget and wrap up the spring session. So what's the holdup? How long might it last? We'll discuss that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Also with us, we have Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime Statehouse reporter and observer. And joining us today, Amanda Vinicky with WTTW's Chicago Tonight. Amanda, always good to have you back with us.
I am always glad to be back in Springfield and on with you, Sean and Charlie.
Well, Amanda, let's start with you. Let's get going on where things are at. Now, we're recording this show on Friday morning. We thought today was supposed to be the final day. It was supposed to be the final day of the spring legislative session. We figured a budget and votes and everything could go well into the evening, maybe even the early morning hours on Saturday. But it looks as though it's going to go longer than that. So, Amanda, what is going on at the state capitol as we record now?
So we know, Sean, that they are going to blow past that Friday deadline that the General Assembly had set for themselves. Anybody who pays attention to state politics knows May 19th isn't the day that you circle in red on your calendar. Rather, that's May 31st. And the expectation, if you are involved in state government, is that, you know, you're not going to really have much of a Memorial Day weekend. It's going to be spent at the Capitol in the throes of budget negotiations and last minute wheeling and dealing on whatever else is left. The deadline was moved up this year, as by the way, it was last year. They met it then, but then there was an election on the horizon. This year, it's really sort of a fake deadline, which is why I think you have seen, you saw, in fact, Wednesday, which is when you would have needed at least some sort of introduction of a budget and some sort of movement, come and go with really a lot of sort of attitude that it didn't happen. And so negotiations are ongoing, and we are told that in a lot of arenas, there's pretty close to a deal, at least between Democrats, who are really the only ones that count here when it comes to a budget deal, because of course they have control of the governor's office and supermajorities of both chambers. But there are some sticking points, and that is why we've got a holdout, and we are going to be heading into the end of May without a budget all wrapped up. But really, again, everybody seems to say that they're not super worried. It's going to happen before that May 31st deadline that sort of signals perhaps trouble. And the governor and legislative leaders continue to say that their priority is both to focus on the Democratic agenda, but also to come out with a budget that they will be able to proclaim as balanced.
Well, one of the issues that has been a sticking point here in trying to get a budget is some changing revenue numbers and also this cost of a program that provides health care for undocumented immigrants. We talked about it a bit on the show last week. The projections for that have gone way up. Does it seem as though they have worked out some agreement on that?
No, that does very much continue to be in the mix, or perhaps the biggest part of the issues there, because it is very costly. And when you have something eating up costs like that, then it means less money for other needs, of course. It's also, I think, a matter of you have politically a Latino caucus and progressive caucus that are very committed to making sure that this program continues, and those who also insist that it be expanded and say, throw back the governor's own language to say that he's the one that continually said that healthcare should be a right, not a privilege. And so yet you do have, again, this insistence that a budget be balanced. So part of the question, and this does get a little bit into the weeds, but it's not just over the cost, but it's over who should be responsible for managing and perhaps any sort of reining in of the program. You have Democrats, legislative Democrats, that is, pointing to the original language and saying that it gives the Pritzker administration a whole lot of leeway. So there is this notion that they will sort of pass the buck, if you will, to the Pritzker administration to make some decisions about that program. Then you have the Pritzker administration sort of pushing back on that, it seems, and saying that they don't have all those capabilities, and it's up to the legislature to put in any sort of guardrails, anything that would leave enrollment down. And so that is also part of this sort of power struggle. And it is, I think, both mechanic and, again, it's also politically, because that could be seen as cutting healthcare, and neither the governor nor legislators want to take the fall for that.
And Charlie, you've watched budget negotiations longer than both Amanda and myself combined. What do you make of all of this at this point?
Well, I think Amanda hit the nail on the head. It's a matter of not wanting to take the blame, because the numbers dictate that the program has to be curtailed in some respects, because there's just not money there for the increase, which it would be, man, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm thinking the projections are that would cost like a billion more dollars to do everything that its proponents want.
Correct. And 1.1 billion, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. And that money's not there unless you, I guess, eliminate any other increases in any other areas. And there are a lot of pressure points there in terms of healthcare. This would be for folks who are immigrants here, but for ongoing healthcare, the fact that hospitals are arguing that their rates need to be increased, as an example, the fact that the education community wants more money, the fact that at one point the local governments and Mayor Brandon Johnson from Chicago were arguing they should get a better share of the state income tax. Well, that's not going to happen. But there's all these pressures. So you can't have one program that's going to increase by $1 billion, particularly a program unlike regular Medicaid, where the federal government reimburses the state 50 cents for every dollar that is spent. This program is basically all state money with very little to no reimbursement. I think there would be some reimbursement for coverage for folks who are pregnant, but not for the bulk of the cost. And so there's going to have to be some, what would you say, cost cutting, some reining in. And the Latino caucus is very adamant that we have to do something to help these folks. And the legislative Democrats don't want to be the ones who will take criticism for cutting it. They'll be able to say, well, we were all for it, but it was that governor's fault. And basically, it'll be up to the governor, because after all, he is the governor. And he's made it clear that he's not going to do an unbalanced budget. And unlike back in the olden days, when you could jack up the revenue estimate and say, oh, well, actually, we're going to have another couple $100 million coming in that we didn't count on before. You can't do that anymore.
Well,
it's going to be a tough vote. Ultimately, it'll be up to the governor. My guess is, for sure, there won't be any new people admitted to the program. And whether or not there will be some other provisions for those already in the program, for example, saying, well, you have to pay a certain amount of the cost yourself, or, well, we covered this procedure and that procedure. In the future, we're not going to cover this one. That kind of thing, something to bring the costs in. And of course, the advocates are going to be very upset for that. And in a sense, and I've said this before, if someone is out without health insurance and they have some, what would you say, some illness, and they can't go to the doctor and get it taken care of right away, that illness becomes more severe, and they wind up in an emergency room where the costs are a lot higher. So in a sense, if we invest the money up front, in the long run, we're going to be saving money. Now, maybe it won't be the state government, maybe it'll be hospitals that have to eat it, and charity care, or maybe the rest of us will have to pay for it as our insurance rates go up. You know, the fact is, we're not going to let people die on the sidewalk. And the question is, how do we manage it?
Well, Amanda, one of the things that certainly, you know, this has been talked about for several weeks, and I guess when I look at this, one of the things that comes to my mind is They've known about it for a long time. Here we are, seeming to be at the stalemate, trying to figure this all out in the final days of the session, which isn't uncommon for state government and how things in the legislature often work. But it also strikes me that maybe there are people out there who are a little concerned right now that they've made promises in this budget, not just on this program, but other programs as well. And now they may have to go back and say, sorry, those are not happening. Is that a concern among some lawmakers?
I think it's got to be, right? Including the governor himself. That said, there's the reality that the budget, it just is dealing with not as much money as has been expected, that there's been a rollback in revenue expectations, and that if you want a balanced budget and to be able to say that, to be able for the governor to be able to continue to claim credit upgrades and look perhaps to ratings agencies for another one, that it has to be kept in check. And so you look at things like, I don't know this, what part of the negotiations it is, but for example, the governor, he has a signature program that he talked about in his budget and State of the State address that involved expanding the pre-K and daycare. If he doesn't get the full amount, he'll still be able to claim, I expanded it by X amount. So if you take off, you know, $10 million, whatever it might be, it still would be a signature program. So I think it's a matter at this point of perhaps fulfilling those promises, just perhaps not to the same degree, so that everybody can claim a win. And there might be some disappointment perhaps from some of the advocacy groups that had thought they were going to get more, but you don't look a gift horse in the mouth, as the saying goes. And so if they are going to be all scaled back, then everybody sort of takes their lumps together, is I think sort of the game plan here.
Well, I don't want to be a negative person here, Charlie, but I think one of the possibilities, and I could see some people might be persuaded on this, would be to use certain accounting tricks, as we've seen before, maybe even things like shorting the pensions. But those types of things might come up on the table if this gets really tight here. Do you anticipate any of that?
I think to the extent that any accounting tricks are attempted, I'm guessing that Comptroller Susana Mendoza would go through the roof. She's been very adamant about making sure that the state lives within its means, and she's been very proud of the fact that we've brought down basically our bill backlog from close to $17 billion a few years ago during the Rauner budget impasse to now where it runs on any given day, it's maybe a billion, or the last week, most of the days, it's been less, the bills that are there in her office. So that's basically, it's not a backlog, it's just accounts payable. Are there tricks that could be done? Yeah, let's say, and I don't think Mendoza would go along with this, but let's say, okay, we'll hold on to these bills. Instead of paying them in a week, we'll pay them in maybe 3 weeks and have some more money. Or you could monkey around with some of the program expansions and say, well, instead of starting this program at the beginning of the new fiscal year on July 1st, will actually start on January 1st, and therefore the costs will only be half. And that was a common trick back in my day. And again, I'm thinking that the comptroller would not like that. Now, she's not in a position, she has no vote on the budget, obviously, but she does have a bully pulpit, which she's employed very well to make the argument that we have to live within our means. And so I'm guessing that those types of things might be considered, but I don't think that they're really going to happen.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler and Amanda Vinicky of WTTW's Chicago Tonight. Well, we will talk more about the budget next week, at least where things stand at that point. But let's move on. The U.S. Supreme Court this week denied an emergency request to put the state's assault weapons ban on hold, and that came from groups who are challenging the ban in court. Amanda, for now, the ban, it stays in place, but there are plenty of court challenges ahead here. So give us sort of the lay of the land where this is at this point.
Are there ever so many court challenges? Lots and lots of attorneys, I suppose, staying busy with this one. So you have the U.S. Supreme Court. I think there is still the potential that the nation's high court could be weighing in on this law in a more fulsome fashion. All that we really got this week was a notice from Amy Coney Barrett, who's in charge of the region for these sort of things, that the court will not be taking up the issue, allowing the ban to stand instead of putting it on hold while the legal challenges continue. And so you have had at the lower federal court level a variance in decisions from the judges. So now those really are all folded into one and going before the U.S. Appeals Court in the Northern District. And so we're going to get some sort of resolution there at some point. Again, the expectation is that no matter what happens, the other side will appeal and hope that the U.S. Supreme Court eventually takes this up and settles it once and for all. But for now, that means that if you are one of the individuals who owns what Illinois has deemed to be an assault rifle, that it needs to be registered with the state of Illinois, and anybody else cannot purchase one. There was a brief window where people were able to buy one, and the last that I know, while these court cases were sort of in between, and so we don't know what happens to those people. Their purchases are sort of in limbo. And then, Sean, it wasn't just action from the U.S. Supreme Court this week. We also had arguments before the Illinois Supreme Court over the ban as well. So no decision. These were just arguments. We are waiting, of course, for the Illinois Supreme Court justices to make any sort of decision. But this is a case in which you had State Representative Dan Calkins and some gun owners suing the governor, the attorney general, and legislative leaders over the assault weapons ban. The arguments there had really rested on the notion that mostly the fact that certain people, be it these folks who are grandfathered and already own assault weapons, as well as, say, police officers, and in certain times of the day, if they're on the job, security guards are able to continue to have them, that was unequal protection, that these people are being treated differently than other FOID card holders. That was the main argument. During the oral arguments, you also had the appellants tried to argue that the Second Amendment should come into play. They got some pushback from that, from a number in one justice in particular, but that is where things stand as of now. We of course don't know how the court will decide, but regardless of what the Illinois Supreme Court does, and that is significant, really, I think we need to be paying supreme attention to the federal court and perhaps, again, eventually the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, Democrats have majorities, supermajorities, in both chambers of the General Assembly. We mentioned right now trying to get a budget done, but they also have been passing a lot of legislation, and they're doubling down on some key issues, and those include using a similar tactic on a couple of bills, and I think this is interesting. One of those relates to guns. It would limit how gun manufacturers and gun dealers can market their products, subjecting them to the Consumer Fraud and Deceptive Business Practices Act. The other deals with abortion, cracking down on what are known as crisis pregnancy centers. These are usually aligned with anti-abortion organizations, and they try to get those who are pregnant seeking an abortion to change their mind. A bill headed to the governor would apply consumer fraud rules, same as the standard that retailers and other businesses are held to these centers. So, Charlie, this whole consumer fraud rules approach to these issues, that seems like a new approach. What is your thought on that?
Yeah, I think it kind of is. You mentioned the one on legislation that would limit the ability of the gun industry to market its wares, and its proponents say it's designed to stop advertisements targeting kids. And I think Senate President Don Harmon in the floor debate showed a picture of an ad where it looked like a little kid, like a toddler with a toy gun. And the basic gist of it of the law would be to subject the gun manufacturers, retailers, to civil liability if they market any firearm accessory or component to people under the age of 18. And they would be held liable if, and this is a quote, they knowingly create, maintain, or contribute to a condition in Illinois that endangers the safety or health of the public by conduct either unlawful in itself or unreasonable under all circumstances including failing to establish or utilize reasonable controls. And so that legislation is going to go to the governor, and the governor is going to sign it. He's been a very strong supporter. He issued a statement saying that gun violence is a public health epidemic. Those who encourage unlawful use of a firearm or target sales of firearms to minors worsen the scourge of gun violence in our communities. And so he will sign that bill as soon as it hits his desk. And it was a lot of controversy in the debate on the bill. It cleared the Senate 34-22, the House 71-40. The opponents were basically Republicans. And it'll be interesting to see, once this bill signs, it again will be challenged, and it'll be challenged as violating the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution about the right to bear arms. But they're taking it from a different angle. They're taking it from basically a consumer fraud or consumer protection angle that limits the kind of advertising that other industries can do that target kids. For example, the tobacco industry. But as Amanda suggested, all of this stuff ultimately will wind up before the U.S. Supreme Court, and that's where the real decisions will be made.
Well, let's save a couple of minutes here at the end of the show to talk about big change at the top in Chicago. Of course, we know that Brandon Johnson won the mayor's race there, and he became the mayor officially this week, being sworn in. Amanda, you said you weren't there for his swearing in, but you did listen to what he had to say. You've been covering a lot of what's going on there in Chicago. So fill us in on sort of what the mayor's first week on the job looks like.
The mayor's first week on the job is somewhat tumultuous. I mean, for starters, let's tie it into the budget talks. He did visit before he officially became mayor. Brandon Johnson came to Springfield, had some asks, not sure how much of them he's going to get, even though he certainly has some allies in the Progressive Caucus in Chicago delegations here in the General Assembly because of what we've been talking about, just sort of tighter finances. The expectation is he's not necessarily going to be coming home or in having an easy time with his first budget by getting money from Springfield for Chicago Public Schools and an increase in the local government distributive fund. Also had a bit of a tangle because there is a progressive group that he is not per se a part of, but members of his team and his transition team are, that put forth a whole host of revenue ideas for the city of Chicago, some of which are quite controversial and far exceed the already controversial and progressive-leaning asks that Johnson himself has as part of the budget plan that he ran on. So looking at, for example, a head tax on city employees that is $33 per worker. So certainly you have a mayor, and I think this is going to be something that we're going to be continually watching throughout his administration, that was boosted by progressive organizations, is closely allied with labor, and was himself an employee of the Chicago Teachers Union. And so how much of a pass are they be going to give him as one of their own, realizing that campaigning is different than governing? And how much is it going to be that he gets the sort of pressure and flack that his predecessors did for not being progressive enough, if in fact he does go to the middle at all? What line is he going to walk? He did distance himself from this proposal, but again, his own proposal, and perhaps that might help his own proposal because it will be seen as more moderating than this one. His speech, he's certainly a powerful orator. It was lengthy, hit all the bases. He did reach out and say, we need to, it's about the soul of Chicago. And he called on everybody, including those who didn't support him, and in particular, seemed to key in on some business leaders. There was some bad taste left in the mouths of those who are more supporters of the police in a line that, but some received very well, and where he compared the tears of a teenager that was killed by a Chicago police officer, his parents, as well as the tears of a police officer who was shot just recently and died. And he said the parents of those tears are the same. That's something that, again, was sort of received well by some as an understanding of the moment and the pain that is so real and so human, no matter what. And then by others who support the police as particularly offensive. Of course, there's no real honeymoon period in a job like this.
All right. Well, let's go to our notes from the field. And Amanda, I'm going to start with you, talking about maybe some of the legislation that's out there we haven't gotten to yet.
Sean, it's hard to choose because there is oh so much, but let's talk about one that I think really caused a stir on the floor. This is something that is not, as we speak, yet making its way to the governor's desk, but regulates bathrooms. And I mean, had you told me in the beginning of my career how much bathroom reporting would be on NPR and public radio, it's not just in Illinois, it is across the country that you're seeing really a lot of legislation regulating this. In particular, this bill is one that would allow for businesses to have multiple occupancy gender neutral bathrooms. Republicans really attacked this, including with language that, again, some saw as quite offensive when you had Senator Neil Anderson say that if his 10-year-old daughter was in one of these washrooms and a man came in, he would beat the living fill in the blank out of that man. So that got applause from some GOP lawmakers and was seen on the Democratic side of the aisle as particularly distasteful, and also is a phobia of those in the LGBTQ community. The sponsor of this measure says that this is, yes, a measure of equality inclusion for the LGBTQ plus folks, but also just practical for, say, exactly maybe folks like Senator Anderson was talking about when he is, you know, when his wife isn't around and his daughter needs to go to the bathroom, that this would be a way for parents or for those who have somebody that they're caring for who is elderly that maybe is of the opposite gender and needs a bit of extra attention, a way to do that. So we'll see where that goes, but the expectation is that it will be going to the governor's desk over GOP objections.
All right. And Charlie.
Well, the magazine U.S. News last week or so came out with a story saying that they had analyzed the 150 most populous metro areas in the country to find the best places to live based on quality of life, the job market, value of living there, people's desire to live there, and so on. And to the chagrin, I'm sure, of most of Chicago, if not Illinois, the number one best place to live in the entire United States of America is a little town called Green Bay, Wisconsin. And I guess to kind of rub salt into the wounds, Chicago made the list, but it was number 123. The top Illinois community, and it's not all in Illinois, partly in Iowa, is the Quad Cities. It came in number 54. Peoria came in number 70. And even St. Louis came in ahead of Chicago at number 100. So there you are, Cub fans and Bear fans.
And Sox fans.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Amanda Vinicky of Chicago Tonight. You can get a podcast of our show available at nprillinois.org through the NPR One app or iTunes. Just look for State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, and join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.